From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines this last week. There's a lot to get to today. So our panel includes Dawn Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Rebecca Boone, the Associated Press supervisory correspondent in the Boise Bureau, and Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, as well as Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Hello.
So let's head back to Tuesday. Let's start with Idaho's primary election. I think almost all of you covered it. So, Melissa, why don't we start with you, and let's talk about the big statewide races first.
Yes, there were, everyone knows by now that Brad Little won that highly contested, very expensive and contentious primary with Lieutenant Governor Janice McKeon and six other challengers. I really think, though, that the huge news of the night was that two incumbents lost, which is pretty rare in Idaho. Idaho voters don't normally boot incumbents, and I couldn't find any examples, certainly not in several decades, of two incumbents losing on statewide races in one night. And so Lawrence Wasdin, seeking a sixth term as Attorney General, lost to Raul Labrador, and Sherry Ybarra, seeking a third term as Superintendent of Public Instruction, lost to Debbie Critchfield. And by a lot, that race wasn't particularly close either. Sherry Ybarra only got 26% of the statewide vote and came in third in a three-way primary.
Right. And Scott, your thoughts on we're going to take these, like, just so folks know, we're going to start with our statewide races, then we'll talk legislative, then we'll go more local. So, Scott, your take, your analysis on these statewide races, because as Melissa said, I mean, two incumbents and not just losing, but losing fairly significantly.
Yeah, and you know, we'll definitely talk about this when we talk about the legislative races, but there was definitely a bit of a red wave that happened on Tuesday that's maybe a little more hidden, particularly when you look at the vote totals. You know, folks woke up in the morning Wednesday and saw that Brad Little won and Scott Bedke won, Debbie Critchfield won, and Phil McGrane won, and kind of breathed a sigh of relief. But then if you look at the numbers a little more closely, there's cause for concern. You know, the governor's race kind of went as predicted. Governor Little won a majority, even with seven challengers. And even if you combined all of those challengers' votes, Brad Little still would have won. The lieutenant governor race between Scott Bedke and Priscilla Giddings was pretty close, or closer, I should say. Mm-hmm. 114,000 people voted for Priscilla Giddings. This is a person who, you know, has been in the news. She was censured and removed from committees for doxing a rape victim. Still 114,000 people voted for her. And in the superintendent of public instruction, Brandon Durst received 90,000 votes. Also an inflammatory candidate, has a lot of baggage and has moved to the far right when it comes to education policy. And he did a lot better, beating out, receiving more votes than the incumbent, Sherry Ybarra. And then, you know, I think most concerning, I think, was the Secretary of State office, Phil McGrane, won. But he didn't win by much. He only won by 4,000 mm-hmm. votes over Dorothy Moon. And Dorothy Moon and a fellow legislator and candidate Senator Mary Souza, they're both election conspiracy theorists. They both believe that Donald Trump legitimately won the presidential election. And Dorothy Moon has brought conspiracy theories to the House floor, speculating that Canadians crossed the border to vote in Idaho. And she received 113, almost 114,000 votes, only 4,000 votes shy of McGrane. Mary Souza received 41,000 votes. So if Souza had, you know, announced on Monday or Friday, the Friday before, that she was dropping out of the race and vote for Dorothy Moon, her ostensibly 41,000 votes would have gone to Dorothy Moon, most likely, and Moon would have won easily. So we were just one press conference away from having Dorothy Moon as our next Secretary of State. I should say that all of these candidates face a challenger, at least one challenger in the November election. But as we know, the Republican primary tends to be the decider, other candidates tend not to do as well in the general election. So the closer look at the numbers show that there was quite a bit of, we can call it anti-establishment candidates doing very, very well at the top of the ticket, even though the only race the anti-establishment group won was Raul Labrador. They made significant gains and showed really strong showings in the top of the ticket.
Mm-hmm. So, Scott, let's talk a little bit more about the attorney general race and Raul Labrador winning the primary, ousting Lawrence Wasdin, who's been in this position for 19 years. I believe one of the longest running AGs we've had in the state of Idaho, maybe the longest. And in this time, I mean, Wasdin, yes, he's a Republican, but he's been very much a voice of reason over the years, which I think has been much appreciated until recently. He really, as he said, called balls and strikes, right? I mean, it was either constitutional or it wasn't constitutional based on what the Constitution says. And with this anti-establishment movement, all of a sudden, as much as they want to invoke the Constitution, they certainly don't want an attorney general in there who will do that. With that said, the day after the election, Raul Labrador, you know, is at a news conference and said that he will always uphold the Constitution. So how anti-establishment is he, really?
That's a good question. You know, he is a former state legislator. He is a former congressman, founding member of the Freedom Caucus in Congress, and, you know, kind of been a anti-establishment politician. You know, I think there were legitimate issues with the COVID response, particularly changing election laws and spending federal relief funds that really hurt Wasdin. And I think there was a sense of, you know, Wasdin has been in office for long enough, I guess was some people were thinking. And then Raul Labrador has pretty good name recognition, particularly among the Republican crowd. And I'll point out that Raul Labrador's vote total was the second highest among those top ticket candidates who had opponents in their races. He had 140,000 votes. So his showing was not just a victory. It was a pretty resounding victory. And he definitely played off that sense of that he's going to be the voice of liberty and freedom against the establishment, and played against, I guess what you'd say, some of Wasdin's weaknesses.
Jenna, can I jump in?
Crap ton of
absolutely.
Money.
Right. So the idea that Wasdin has made, maybe not enemies, but certainly not made friends at the State House is nothing new. I was looking at my notes from debates from 8 years ago, and we had almost the same questions about him calling balls and strikes and him not telling lawmakers what they want to hear. It wasn't that long ago that we were covering how he and then Governor Butch Otter weren't on speaking terms because of disagreements. And so when people say that they're going to uphold the Constitution, I mean, if everybody agreed on how the Constitution was interpreted and applied, we wouldn't need lawyers. You know, it's just the idea that you know, he isn't sincere, that Raul Labrador isn't sincere when he says he's going to uphold the Constitution because he has a different view of it than Lawrence Wasdin. That's the whole point of this. That's the whole point of the practice of law. And so I'm not going to, you know, with respect to Scott, I'm not going to say that anything was concerning or not concerning, but I really think that Labrador getting such a high vote total and you know, the legislative races that we're going to talk about later in the show, it shows that Idahoans want conservative representation. And there were a lot of different factors, certainly in the other statewide top of the ticket races. But those Moon and Labrador vote totals, especially, I think really show where the Republican electorate is going in Idaho.
And Dawn, I think you said something about how much money Labrador raised. That says something as well.
I don't have the numbers in front of me, but he significantly outraised the current attorney general. And outside money was a significant factor in, frankly, all these races. Some of it we know about and can see, and some of it we don't know about and can't see because of some differences in how state and federal reporting requirements work. And so we don't even really know all the money that was spent. We will in months to come when it's a little too late to matter. But, the electorate is primary and the votes do matter, but you do see a correlation often between spending and vote totals.
Mm-hmm. So let's dig into the legislative races. And Melissa, I'll start with you because, yes, we saw more moderate Republicans win the statewide races, but we're seeing some big changes coming up in the legislature, one being the Senate really going more red.
Right, especially in the Senate. There were a lot of establishment Republicans who lost. And some of them, I don't think, were very high on folks' radar. Certainly, I had been watching some of the races. Senator Carl Crabtree, for example, was one who I expected that he was going to probably lose his primary based on some of the campaign literature I saw. But Jeff Akinbrod Canyon, Ada County, here in the Treasure Valley, I didn't expect that he was going to lose his primary. Jim Patrick in rural Twin Falls County and Gooding and up to Camas County, I didn't think that he was going to lose. And so there were certainly some very conservative candidates who also lost. But if you look up north in Kootenai County in particular, I think every single candidate who was endorsed by the Kootenai County Republican Central Committee, every single one of those candidates won. If you haven't seen that before, usually it's been a mix of lawmakers like Paul Amador and, Luke Malik previously. And now it's all very, very conservative Republicans who are going to be on that ticket in the general election. And so I really think what we're seeing is a shift that among the Republican primary voters, that especially in some areas of the state, they want more conservative representation.
Mm-hmm. And Scott, I mean, let's dig into that a little bit more, because I think Melissa brought up a good point that definitely in certain parts of the state, in particular in North Idaho, it's becoming more and more evident and through the vote that they want even more conservative lawmakers. That's not necessarily the case in parts of southern Idaho. I mean, if you think of Ada County, but there are these pockets. So what does that potentially mean when we look at the next legislative session?
Canyon County really shifted to the right. Canyon County was very, very, very red. And Greg Cheney lost to Chris Traikel. And like Melissa said, Jeff Akinbrod lost to Brian Lenny, a very extreme right candidate. The Senate has been called the adults in the room, the moderating factor. And if you look at the folks who lost their elections, Jim Woodward, Fred Martin, Jim Patrick, Tammy Nichols is now going to be a state senator. Phil Hart is going to be a state senator because some of these don't have challengers in the general election. So I think you're going to see that the Senate is not going to be as much of that moderating influence against bills in the House. You're going to see more fights over whether Big Bird is indoctrinating children. We're going to see fights over higher education budget, K-12 budget. We're going to see fights over CRT and all sorts of cultural war issues. And that stuff is not going to get stopped in the Senate as much as it has in the past. You know, that's my prediction anyway. With seeing some of these folks who won, I think you're going to see less of a moderating influence in the Senate in 2023.
And Melissa, what does that mean then for Governor Little? I mean, yes, he will, you know, be starting a new term come January. He will likely, of course, win the general election in November. I mean, potentially more things coming to his desk, I would think, that he either will need to veto or go along with what we could potentially see as more of an even more far right lean.
It's certainly going to have an impact on those state house dynamics, especially with Attorney General Labrador working with lawmakers, you know, assuming that Labrador wins the general election. Working with lawmakers and advising them on the constitutionality of certain proposals. And so remember, too, it's not just the governor's relationship with the legislature as a whole. It's also their interactions with legislative leadership. And the makeup of the Senate and the House, especially those Republican caucuses, determines majority leadership. That has, that's the key factor in deciding who is going to chair those committees and who is going to decide which legislation gets heard. And so depending on who becomes the next House Speaker and whether or not Senate Majority Leader Chuck Winder can keep his post, that's going to have a huge influence moving forward. And we're not going to know until after the general election some of those Republican candidates in both the House and the Senate will have competitive general election primaries, particularly, I think, Lori Likely, who is more of a moderating force among the Republican, new Republican want to be senator. But she's going to have a tough general election with a Democrat candidate from Blaine County. Same with Cody Galloway in District 15. She beat Fred Martin. She's going to have a tough general election challenge too. So all of that is going to determine who makes up those committee assignments, who chairs those committees, what legislation gets heard and passed, and what Governor Little is going to have to consider next year.
Dawn, I want to bring it down to definitely a local level right now, and let's talk Ada County. What did we see happen in Ada County? Any patterns coming out, anything like that?
You know, I think it's interesting. It's hard to say if there are any patterns on the county level. Things are, I think, less defined, especially in a county like Ada, where, you know, Ada County is as purple as it gets in Idaho, I would say. And but we have some interesting things shaping up. The county commission level, Commissioner Rod Beck is running again. He ran unopposed in the Republican primary. He will move on in the general election to face another well-known name in Stan Ridgway, the former Eagle mayor on the Democratic side of that ticket. So we'll have an interesting race there. For seat three, this was an interesting primary on the GOP side with former County Commissioner Sharon Ullman and one-time Democrat Sharon Ullman, I would add, running in the GOP primary. She's kind of been a perennial candidate there. She's been in office and out and back in and ran. And she lost in a three-way race against Tom Daley, who's a former federal Republican official in the Trump administration, also served on the redistricting committee for the state, and Don Retzloff. So Tom Daley will face off against Patricia Nilsson in the fall on the Democratic side. Sheriff, there was a fairly contentious but not close race against current Ada County Sheriff Matt Clifford and Doug Traubel. Sheriff Clifford, I should say, was chosen in the chosen by the county commission last year to replace the former sheriff, Steve Bartlett, who resigned. Clifford beat Traubel in the GOP primary and will face Victor McCraw. At Assessor, we had an interesting race. A whole bunch of folks ran, and another familiar face and name will be on the ballot in the fall in Rebecca Arnold, former Commissioner Arnold served at ACHD for quite a long time. She lost a very narrow general election. It came down to like 30 votes, I think, last year. Lost her seat and now is running for assessor, won the GOP primary, and faces off against Lori Barrera, the Democrat in the fall. And then at coroner, we had an interesting race. I think we mentioned Superintendent of Schools candidate Brandon Durst earlier in this program. Brandon Durst did not win that race, and his wife, Sherry Durst, ran for coroner and also did not win and was defeated handily by Rich Riffle in the GOP primary. And Riffle will face off against the incumbent coroner of Dottie Owens. So it's really interesting because it's a whole bunch of fairly familiar names that voters in Ada County will see on the ballot. And we see this kind of funny thing that happens in Ada County where the county offices tend to go back and forth a little bit from red to blue. In presidential years, we tend to see a more Republican result. And in the off years, we tend to see a little bit more of a Democratic result. But who knows what will happen this year? We don't have real high-profile statewide races. For instance, you'll remember 4 years ago, we had Governor Little facing off against Paulette Jordan, the Democrat, for governor. And that was a pretty potent race. And Paulette Jordan got a lot of votes. And we haven't seen that same energy on the Democratic side for governor this year. So who knows? Who knows what the turnout will look like? Who knows what it will see? But these county races and the point we often make at Boise Dev, county and municipal races are often the ones that have the most impact on people's daily lives and also tend to be the ones that gets less talked about. So we'll keep writing about these county and municipal races as we head towards fall.
Yeah, it's such a good point, Don. Rebecca, I have not forgotten about you. So apologies for finally talking. But in all seriousness, Rebecca, I want to talk about something that the Associated Press has been covering, and this is the baby formula shortage. So first, can you talk to us briefly about what we know as to why we are in this baby formula shortage?
Sure. So the largest, at the center of the shortage is really this large domestic baby formula manufacturing plant in Michigan. There was some indication that there was like a contamination problem. They found some bacteria or something at the plant itself. And so they had to shut down operations there for a while. And of course, with all the supply chain issues that we've been having in the U.S. And the fact that the FDA is really restricted imports of baby formula from other countries, it's just caused a real struggle for parents who are trying to get formula to feed their kids. It's been an ongoing problem, and it looks like the Biden administration is allowing more imports now from other countries, and the government is working to reopen this big manufacturing plant in Michigan. It's, you know, we're still looking at a shortage potentially lasting for a while.
Right. I mean, last I heard, at least potentially until June or through June. And with that said, Rebecca, there's been this debate that's come up, which frankly I find to be asinine, is that, well, just breastfeed if you can't get formula. Rebecca, it is frustrating on so many levels to even have to have this conversation.
Right. So even Bette Midler at one point tweeted out, like, try best breastfeeding. It's free and accessible. And she later kind of walked back her comments saying that, you know, she recognizes that not everybody can do that. But here's the thing. There is a big, there can potentially be a lot of stigma surrounding how you feed your baby. And there are a lot of reasons why people may not be able to or might not choose to breastfeed. The World Health Organization recommends, and most major medical organizations do recommend, that if possible, you know, exclusively breastfeed babies for 6 months. But experts also acknowledge that comes with a cost and can be really challenging. Dr. Lori Feldman-Winter, who's chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics breastfeeding group, told us for this story that we ran this week that it's really challenging, that there are some kids with medical problems, like they might end being able to metabolize sugar in breast milk and require formula. Women might have medical conditions that make it difficult to breastfeed. For instance, if you have HIV or are undergoing cancer treatment, it's not recommended. And also there's just, you know, if you're a working woman, if you can't pump milk in like a McDonald's bathroom very effectively or enjoyably, right? So yeah. For a lot of people, it's just not a viable option. And it's great that we have these formulas that can lead to healthy, happy, well-fed babies. But there's this big stigma. And so this week we talked to a lot of women, a lot of parents who have been kind of dealing how the shortage is sort of surfaced those feelings of guilt that they might have as mothers, mm-hmm. or this pressure that they might have gotten along the way to try to breastfeed as opposed to choosing formula.
Right. And I think too, like I look back on my time. I mean, my children are now 14 and 10 years old. And with my first child, he had to be in the NICU for the first 5 days of his life. So guess what? You're not breastfeeding. You're trying to pump. I could never make enough. So by 6 weeks, he had to exclusively be formula fed. I could not produce. I mean, that is just the way it is. And the guilt that you feel as a mother, especially a new mother, your child's already been in the NICU. You can't breastfeed. I mean, this is totally not the plan you had at all. Everything goes out the window when a baby comes into it. And you are judged, Rebecca. I mean, you are, and you feel that judgment. And then to now, even 14 years later, I look and I see these comments, and it is so incredibly frustrating because the idea that breast is best, I mean, fed is best. My youngest almost ended up in the hospital because I so wanted to breastfeed him that I, again, did not produce enough. And at a week old, he almost had to be put into the hospital because he had such severe jaundice because I was not producing. So yes, I might be sharing a little too much here, but I mean, Rebecca, you're a mom. Melissa, you're a mom. We all have our own stories around this. And what I do know is that I think we all have healthy children. And at the end of the day, that's what matters.
Right. And this formula has really hit some families that are just have no other choice but formula, particularly hard. You know, my kids both had severe food intolerances that would cause GI bleeding to everything I ate in my breast milk. So I cut out all sorts of things with my daughter from my diet, and it didn't work. And so she had to go, both my kids had to go on this very expensive prescription-only formula. In our case, it was called Neocate. Elicare is another brand that makes them. They're also often used for kids who are tube fed for various GI issues. Those have also been hit by this shortage. So, you know, I talked to some moms who have just been scrambling to try to get their baby the only thing that they can eat and survive. I mean, some of these conditions are why we had, you know, sickly babies die before they invented these formulas, mm-hmm. right? Because it just, some kids absolutely need this stuff to be safe and healthy. I talked to one woman who was really trying. She had her kid relied on this formula, and she had to actually cut it with an over-the-counter formula because that was the only one she could find. So she was taking this prescription Neocate or Elicare, and she was mixing it half and half with that, with just like a over-the-counter formula for babies with sensitive stomachs, just praying for about 3 weeks that her child wouldn't get sick. And in that case, luckily the baby was fine. But it's just an incredible amount of pressure and guilt. And, you know, there's the easiest babies to parent are the ones that aren't yours, right? Because we can all judge exactly. from afar about what to do. But until you're living in the trenches and really experiencing the nuances of these tough decisions that parents face, you know, I think we should probably all withhold our judgment a bit.
Right.
And Becky, I had covered this a little bit last week and how it's especially affecting rural families who rely mm-hmm. on WIC. And so with WIC benefits, you can't buy formula online. And so if you live in, say, Chalice and there's no formula at your grocery store, or the couple grocery stores that are in that town, you might be having to drive to Salmon or Stanley or even further to try and find these formulas. And so it's a very serious, dire situation for rural, all families who rely on formula, but rural families especially are really hit hard by this.
I think that's I'll just say it's interesting to watch social media. A local person who works at a PR agency here tweeted about an hour ago that the Costco in Meridian has many of these formula brands available, limit two per customer. And so you're starting to see people like try and help others when this is available at stores.
Right.
And actually, all the women that I talked to were said that they had, you know, that they'd had other people that either they had come across an extra bottle of or a can of formula and they had passed it on to another family that they knew was desperately searching, or that they had a sister who was an oversupplier with her milk supply who had offered breast milk to other families, you know, frozen breast milk to other families to feed their babies. So it is. They all said it was really gratifying to see this kind of community come together. But with that has also been some scammers trying to, you know, like sell extra cases of formula on Facebook or what have you. And then they end up just, you know, taking the money and running. So it's like any supply crisis. There's, you know, people try to help. And then you got to be wary, though, because there are some who want to take advantage.
Mm-hmm. But I think, Melissa, too, you bring up such a good point that, you know, once again, there is such an impact on low-income families. And we should note, too, I think with WIC, is that normally there is only one brand that they can buy. So if that brand isn't available, I mean, even if there's another brand, if you're on WIC, you can't buy it. And I do believe the Biden administration is changing that for now. But these are dire situations for families. And I think that maybe people forget that. And I would just say once again that, as Becky put it very well, keep your opinions to yourself on this one. A fed baby is the best baby. That's best. It is what families need to do. So we're going to take a break. We're going to come back and finish up the show. I want to thank you, though, for talking about this. I think it is something that we all need to recognize and understand. So, Rebecca, tell us about the case of Pam Hemphill. A lot of folks may not be familiar with her, but I would guess that we all remember the January 6th insurrection.
Right. So Pam Hemphill is a Boise woman who is one of the handful of people from Idaho who have been charged in connection with their alleged participation in the January 6th siege of the U.S. Capitol in 2021, obviously not this year. And she has pleaded guilty to one count of misdemeanor parading. So she is facing sentencing on the 24th, actually. And I'm so sorry, but I'm just going to switch my headset real quick.
Sorry, can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
Okay, sorry about that. Technical difficulties.
Worries.
So,
live radio, Rebecca, that happens.
Yep. So prosecutors filed a sentencing memo in Ms. Hemphill's case last Wednesday, and that's where they lay out what sort of penalty they would like her to face when she is sentenced next week. They noted in particular that she had participated in something that happened at the Idaho State House the previous year. Hemphill was a member of the group People's Rights that was founded by Ammon Bundy. And they, along with other protesters, were at the Boise Capitol in 2020, protesting over coronavirus related restrictions. And in that instance, they forced their way, this large group of people rather, forced their way into a gallery in the Capitol, breaking a door in the process. Well, like many other people who were at the US Capitol on January 6th, Pam Hemphill was, you know, live streaming at times. She was putting videos on social media about what she did while she was there. And in one video that she posted, she actually compared breaking windows at the federal building to the actions the protesters at the Idaho State House had taken. In another video, she talked about, you know, oh, I didn't get into trouble after being found inside the Capitol because I told police I'd just been pushed into the building by the crowd. Prosecutors cited all of those things in their sentencing memo, and they said, we think that she should be sentenced to 2 months plus a term of probation and ordered to do community service, in part because she actually encouraged people to go to the Capitol. She encouraged them to break glass like they, quote, did in Boise, you know, all of these things. Well, this week, Pam Hempel's attorney responded in court, and he said, actually, you know, incarceration for 2 months probably isn't appropriate because, unlike any of some of the other protesters, she didn't attempt to steal anything from the building. She didn't commit any violent or destructive acts to people or property. You know, she may have talked to compared these things, but she didn't actually do them. And that she was actually left awestruck or exalted by the beauty of the building itself. They aren't contesting the facts in the government sentencing memo, but rather they're pointing out that her attorney is pointing out that Hemphill did at times implore others to remain peaceful during this Capitol riot, and that she's had a really rough life and she's had to overcome a lot. She's been sober for 42 years. She relies on her religious faith. She was recently treated for cancer, and that she's been struggling to sort of square her own thoughts about intending to record this event with also then being overcome by what they described as partisan feelings that caused her to cross the line from test to illegal behavior. So they're asking for probation without any jail time. And we will find out what the judge decides to do, presumably on May 24th.
Okay. Melissa, the U.S. Senate, I believe yesterday, approved a $40 billion military and humanitarian aid to the Ukraine. What do we know about how our senators voted on this?
It was a rare split vote for Crapo and Risch. Usually, Idaho senators Mike Crapo and Jim Risch vote together, especially on a lot of major issues. This Ukraine aid package was a rare split vote. Crapo voted no. Senator Jim Risch, ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, of course, did vote to support that. It's been a contentious issue among some Senate Republicans. There have been some who have said, look, we don't like how expensive this is. We understand people's concerns, but think about the cost of not providing the aid. Think about the cost of Russia winning this fight. And so that, again, a rare split vote between the two of them. And I think that that's going to be interesting to watch moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Dawn, a lot to get to from Boise Dev this week. I mean, outside of the elections. So start with some big changes coming to the airport in McCall.
Yeah, Boise Dev's Autumn Robertson chased this story down for us. The city council there approved a new airport master plan, and it's got a whole bunch of things going on, increasing the length of the runway, which will allow them to get slightly larger planes in there. They're working on new snow storage, additional hangars, getting rid of obstructions like trees, working on the pavement, all sorts of stuff, a new taxi lane. Important to note, this does not mean that the McCall Airport will likely see commercial service anytime soon. There is no regularly scheduled commercial service into McCall right now. There are some charter flights, but United Airlines isn't flying 737s in there.
Right.
And so that's not expected and probably wouldn't be for at least 20 years, is what a consultant told the council up there. The projects will likely cost upwards of $40 million, and you'll start to see those improvements roll out in coming years.
Wow. Also, Dawn, let's bring it to Boise. And I know Boise Dev reported on this a while ago, and this was some apartments coming to the downtown area. It was going to take up an entire, street block?
Yeah, I always just like a headline with with something clever in it. And so our headline here was large downtown Boise apartment complex. There's my pop-up over the top. Downtown Boise apartment complex gets okay after the developers agree to cut a hole in it. What happened here is a firm proposed to take over the entire block where the old A1 heating sits. It's at Front Street and 11th Street. I'm sorry, at 12th Street downtown. They wanted to build an apartment complex that would have go around the entire block and then in the middle have a courtyard for residents. The city, in a way that maybe was less than fully transparent, and we are looking for some additional public records on this, had extensive back and forth with the developer and said, yeah, you need to not vacate the alley through the middle of the site. The city of Boise for quite a long time has tried to preserve alleyways in the downtown area. They heard from a consultant in like 2017, I believe, by the name of Jeff Speck, who encouraged them to cut down on so-called super blocks. Super blocks are basically just big blocks that you can't get a pedestrian through. And so there's always been kind of a policy allergy to that. And so they went to the developer and said, hey, this is going to get a tough time getting approved without the alley. So the developer came back. They turned one big building into two slightly smaller buildings. There was a little bit of back and forth with the Planning and Zoning Commission about this, but the number of units on the project doesn't actually change. They just reconfigured this, and the two buildings will be connected by sky bridges. So that got approval and could start construction someday. I don't predict anymore because construction costs, it seems like everything takes forever to get built. But that would be the Saratoga Apartments downtown at 12th and Front.
And Don, I want to wrap up today with some restaurant closures. I mean, I know we've seen some restaurant closures. I mean, you always see them, right? I think in the pandemic, we saw some, but there has been a kind of coming fast and furious string of closures. What, in the last week?
So fast and so furious that since I sent the note to your producer last night with my story list, there is another one.
Really?
Main Street Deli and Il Sugo on Main Street closed in August, saying they would be open in a few weeks after they got their Meridian location up and going. Turns out that's not true. The downtown Main Street Deli is now permanently closed. Equipment's out of there. It's for lease. In addition, Flatbread Pizza on the second floor of the 8th and Main building closed recently. They say that that's a staffing issue, that they were having trouble staying open consistently. So that space is also for lease. And I will note that all the equipment is still in there. And so they're trying to find somebody who can come in on a turnkey basis. Flatbread's other locations in Bound Crossing and in Eagle, North Meridian Eagle, are still open. Meraki Street Food in the Bodo area also will close. They, I think, are still open today. They closed this weekend is my recollection. And then there's a whole bunch of others. We actually listed them out today. 8th Street Deli, Mala Luna, you'll remember Old Chicago closed, Ben and Jerry's closed, Coned Pizza closed, Good Burger, Forenza Pizza, El Gallo Giro, Hey Penny, Kiwi, Shake and Bake, Giro Shack, and others in the months since the pandemic. Some of those have been backfilled by other restaurants, but many of them haven't. And I work downtown, and I'll tell you anecdotally, I feel like I have a lot fewer places to go for lunch. And some of that is closures. Some of that is staffing. And for those of us who are working in offices downtown, it's kind of a joke that on Monday there's nowhere to get lunch because some of the very few places that are open the rest of the days don't open on Monday. And so it could be hard to find a bite that's not repetitive. Maybe that'll change in coming months, but for right now, definitely fewer options in the downtown Boise.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I want to thank all of you for your time today. We've been talking with Don Day with BoiseDev.com, Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press, Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Statesman, and Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television. Guys, have a good weekend. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jenna.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I want to thank all of you for being a part of Idaho Matters. We always appreciate you joining us. Our senior producer is Samantha Wright. Our assistant producer is Hannah Gardosky. Our executive producers are Paul Sterling and Tom Michael. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you next weekend.